This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto in New York. Ever walked into a room or a building and said, wow, this feels so nice in here? You know, the design, the view just frees up my mind, makes me relax. There's a real tangible feeling to the surroundings. How do your surroundings affect the way you think or feel? Are you more productive at work if you have a lot of shelf space to organize your books and papers? Is your experience in church different if you're sitting in a worn and warm wooden pew versus that cold metal chair? Can a stay in the hospital be more pleasant if your room is designed a certain way? Intuitively, it makes sense that the walls and the furnishings of our immediate space affect our brain. It matters if your walls are white or green or blood red. But why? What is it about the shape of a building or a hallway or the color of a wall that affects the way we think and feel and work? And are there any universals, you know, certain designs that affect all of us in the same way? Well, architects and engineers, scientists and designers are thinking about these questions of creating spaces that make you feel healthier, more creative. And this hour we'll be talking about an emerging field of study, building design for the mind, neuroarchitecture. How do you measure what effect a building has on you? Is it possible to create experiments that show why we respond to our immediate environment in certain ways? We're going to be talking about all of this hour, and if you'd like to join us, please do. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, and as always, you can surf over to our website at Science Friday for more information. Let me introduce my guests. Two of them are on vacation, and we're very happy that they're taking time to talk with us. John Eberhard is the Latrobe Fellow on the Board of Fellows at the American Institute of Architects and the Director of Research Planning for the AIA. He's also on the Advisory Board of the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture. He joins us by phone from Moose Pond, Maine. Thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
I'm glad to do it, Ira. Thank you.
You're welcome. Eduardo Macaño is the Dean of the School of Biological Sciences at the University of San Diego in California, and Professor of Biological Sciences specializing in neuroscience. He also sits on the Advisory Board of the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture and joins us from Ely, Minnesota. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Macaño.
You're welcome, and I'm happy to be here, Ira.
We're going to be joined later by some other folks. Let me get this whole idea rolling. Now, John Eberhard, when we were talking, I think it was over a beer last time,
yeah.
And you were telling me about a very unusual story. I mean, the story of about the Salk vaccine and Jonas Salk brought this to mind. Tell us that story.
Well, Jonas Salk says that back in the 50s when he was trying to find a cure for polio, that he had gotten stuck intellectually in his research. And for some reason, he decided what he needed was a sabbatical. And he went to the old church, the Abbey of Assisi, in Assisi, Italy. He stayed there for a couple of weeks. And he said something about the architectural setting there was so conducive to stimulating his imagination that that's where he came up with the whole idea of the Salk vaccine and how to make it. And went back to his laboratories in Pittsburgh and proceeded to do so.
So it was the environment, his surroundings, that suddenly made him release his creativity somehow, unblocked him?
That's what he said, and we believe him now. And that was the reason he thought that some place in the architectural world there should be an organization and people who are working on the connections between the brain sciences or neurosciences and the architectural experiences that people have when they're inside of buildings.
Mm-hmm. So the American Institute of Architects now has taken this on as one of their goals to try to figure out this connection?
Yes, and it's done so by establishing in San Diego, because there's so many neuroscientists there, an Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture. And that academy began its life in May, and we've now had a couple of months under our belt and are making progress. And Eduardo, who's on the telephone with us, is a member of this advisory board to this academy, as well as five or six other neuroscientists and several architects nationally known.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Macaño, we have a lot of neuroscientists who come on, and they talk to us about how they put people in a brain scanner a PET scanner, whatever scanner, that they watch the brain light up with activity by, you know, showing them different pictures of things. Can you create sort of an experiment, maybe this way, maybe another way, where you could watch the brain react to architecture?
Well, it depends, of course, on what methodology you do use. I mean, some of it, like what is called functional MRI, you actually have to be in a machine. Mm-hmm. But we can actually present images while you're lying there and let you respond to different kinds of changes and see what happens to your brain. You have to keep in mind that a lot of our responses are unconscious, actually, and we don't really have any sense of how our brain is working, as you know, we have some kind of conscious experience. We really don't know what is going on inside.
Right. Also joining us now is Dr. Robert McGee. He's Institute Architect and Senior Facilities Officer for Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He joins us from the studios of KUHF in Houston. Thank you for being with us, Mr. McGee. Following up on that point by Eduardo, is there any way that we can measure, you know? Is there any empirical evidence that a building can affect the way we feel or think?
I'm not sure that we have any evidence that a building can affect that, but we do a lot of things as architects to try to do good buildings, and we think there's good results from that.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of anecdotal data, correct? As John Eberhard was telling us about Jonas Salk.
Sure. For instance, 20 years ago, some investigators at the University of Utah decided to put a little coffee room in the center of their lab. They couldn't drink coffee in the lab due to EH&S regulations. So they put this as a glass box in there. And pretty soon, when someone was in there having a cup of coffee, people could see them. They joined them, and it created a kind of interconnectivity or a richer intellectual environment. And these what we call interaction spaces, have really become important. Our scientists feel that they're as important as building good labs. So we've tried to take those thoughts and really make connections in space that stimulate people to interact with each other through some small physical change in the environment by a small space.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let me get this out of the way first, John Eberhard. How is this different? We're going to get phone calls, so let's head it off at the pass if that's where we should. How is this different from feng shui?
Well, I think feng shui at the moment, anyway, is a belief system. There, as far as I know, there is no scientific method that's available to check whether or not the qi that supposedly flows through the Earth's mantle and the qi that flows through our body in fact exist. If you are a believer in feng shui, as I understand it, there is reason to believe that by aligning those two qis, that is the qi in the body and the qi in the Earth's mantle, one provides a positive environment for humans. And particularly that if you don't align them properly, that there can be bad consequences for the humans.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking about how you would design an experiment for to see the effects of a building on people. It's, you know, it's not an easy proposition. It's a social science. But you'd get off to a good start if you had a lot of people, lots and lots of people to take part in the experiment. And as Director of Research for the Government Services Administration's Public Building Service, my next guest, Kevin Campshire, is responsible for finding office space for over 1 million government employees. And each year he finds a new cubicle, a corner office, as the case may be, for an average of 60,000 people. What better experimental group to test the effects of office space than on worker productivity than those dilberted folks over there and all those cubicles. Joining us now from HIS, probably a well-designed office in Washington, is Mr. Campshire. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us about this study that you're going to be conducting.
We're actually conducting a whole series of studies on different subjects. The one we talked about earlier was precisely to look at the effects of stress on people and whether we can modulate the physical environment to reduce the negative effects of stress. And we've got an old, clunky office in Denver that we're trying to improve. It's an old warehouse that was built for the military before World War II. and we're trying to do a lot of different things and then measure the effects on stress. And we're working with the National Institutes of Health and with the American Institute of Architects to make sure that the study is done well and soundly.
And what do you think kind of results are you looking for?
Well, in this particular case, the organization that is in the space wants to do two things. They want principally to reduce stress for the workers that are there and also to help them form teams more readily, more nimbly, more quickly to respond to their customer needs. And so we're measuring social networks. You talked about the behavior of people. We're measuring the trust in the organization to see if it goes up, measuring the social networks to see if they get broader and deeper. And we're also measuring the effects of stress. We'll be doing heart rate monitors and cortisol testing to see whether the movement from the old space to the new space actually does have a beneficial aspect on the social networks and a beneficial aspect on stress.
So you actually will take blood samples from these people to see?
No blood samples, but they'll wear a heart monitor for a 24-hour period, and they'll wear a little patch like a Band-Aid that will collect cortisol and other hormones.
From perspiration.
Yes, from perspiration.
Hmm. But there's so many factors when you deal with people. How do you weed out, you know, the factors that don't count?
We do that by doing a number of different studies. I mean, we'll be able to tell whether stress goes up or down as a result of this experiment. We'll be able to tell that the things that we did in the physical environment had an effect. But obviously, we're doing more than one thing. As you rightly point out, we're adding natural light. We're making the density of people different. We're providing a more greater variety of spaces. And we won't be able to isolate each one. But if we do 50 studies over the next 3 or 4 years, then we'll start to see the patterns that go cross-study. And that's where you start weeding out the different variables.
Eduardo Macano, can you expect, what kind of practical results can you expect from something like this?
Well, I think that the design of the experiment is excellent in the sense that it is measuring parameters that we know affect both the quality of the experience of the worker, but also their ability to be effective at their job. I think the key issue in terms of what we learn, although of course we could do this by accretion of different types of studies, I think the key is going to be to set up sufficient, what we call scientifically, controls to make sure that, for example, moving somebody, just by moving them, might relieve some of the stress. So that, I'm sure, that's part of the design of the experiments. In the long run, I think from the point of view of the neuroscientists, we'd like to really understand how that input from the outside affects certain functions of the brain, some of which are conscious and we can respond to, and some of which are unconscious. And I think the response that is being measured by the GSA study is both conscious and unconscious. To some extent, there will be, I'm sure, some attempt to understand how the workers are actually responding by asking them. But looking at stress by looking at heart rate, which we don't control unless we are, of course, of certain religions, or the amount of hormones that come out on our perspiration. Those are kind of autonomous responses. So they'll be able to see both. Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about architecture and how you feel and what else it might be doing to your mind and body. Stay with us. We'll take your questions. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. This hour we're talking about neuroarchitecture, the design of buildings, a new field of how your environment is linked into your brain and how it affects it. And then, you know, the brain's hooked up to the rest of your body. What other kind of effects might it have? With my guest, Kevin Kamscher, Director of Research for the GSA's Public Building Service, Robert McGee, Institute Architect and Senior Facilities Officer at the Howard Hughes Medical Institution. John Eberhardt is the Latrobe Fellow on the Board of Fellows at the American Institute of Architects and Advisory Board Member of the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture. Edward Macano is the Dean of School of Biological Sciences at the University of San Diego, California. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me ask you, I know you have to go, Kevin. What is there about, is it just moving people? I mean, it's got to be more than just moving people around that, you know, has an effect on them.
No, I think we're pretty sure from a number of other studies there that a wide variety of things in the physical environment affect people. We know that the healthiness of the air does, the ability to control the environment, the amount of light, views of nature, variety in spaces, privacy and openness, and the ability to move around all have an effect on human beings and their behavior. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do here is design the studies to be able to measure how that relates back to specific architectural features and then how that relates through human behavior to organizational performance. Because fundamentally what we're about is being able mm-hmm. to make organizations more effective.
I read some of your writings and you say it said something very interesting that it's sort of futile. It's a fundamental flaw, you say, to try to think about designing a building for 10 years down the road, where you're going to be 10 years from now.
Because people and organizations aren't going to be the same 10 years from now. I mean, I don't know a single organization today that looks like it was 10 years ago in the government or in the private sector or mm-hmm. in the state or in academia for that matter. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we try to build in is the ability to change and the ability for the architecture to change. And you can do that by flexibility and any number of other techniques. Right. But we're also trying to, you know, the point of the science here is to try and measure what those effects are in a scientifically sound way. And that's tricky because, as you pointed out earlier, it's got multiple different disciplines. It's got the social science disciplines, psychology and sociology. It's got the medical disciplines, and it's got the physical disciplines of physics and architecture and design all mm-hmm. working together, and then coupling that with the business management disciplines to see how it all affects the performance of the organization itself.
What do people complain about most?
Two things, acoustics and air quality and temperature.
Not the lighting?
That's third, mm-hmm. but the top two things all of the time are acoustics and mm-hmm. air temperature and quality, and the lack of control over both of those.
Mm-hmm. Are general managers aware of these things, you know, about optimizing these three things?
I think some managers of buildings are aware of it. Managers of organizations, probably much less so. And in fact, we get very few complaints registered in our databases about acoustics because everybody thinks you just can't do anything about it. It is what it is.
Yeah, the air rushing out also, these vents sometimes are so loud in certain places.
And it, you know, the ironic thing is, as you build newer buildings and they're quieter, then the noise of the people isn't masked by these clunky old systems, and mm-hmm. sometimes it becomes more intrusive.
You know, many years ago, I did a story on a submarine. We're talking about maybe 20 years ago on a very famous attack submarine, and I was on the submarine, and the executive officer was showing me around, and he's showing me how cramped it was and what life would be like in the submarine. And I noticed that in the bunks, how, you know, they were small and crowded, as you might imagine, every bunk had a fluorescent light, which gave off the worst yellow color I had ever seen. I mean, you used to think of fluorescence. And I said, you ever thought of full-spectrum lighting to make it look a little more like it's daylight in here? And it's 20 years ago, and he said, I don't know what you're talking about. So
well, I think people
gave up right then.
Right. But now they do understand that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us, and good luck on your studies.
Thank you very much.
Kevin Kamscher is Director of Research for the GSA's Public Building Service, and he has a million people under his tutelage there in the government. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, is our number. Is it possible to then feel that because our brains are hooked to the rest of our bodies that the architecture is going to affect our health and maybe the functioning of our brains in some way, gentlemen?
Well, Ira, there's an example that occurred to me while you were talking with others that hasn't changed much in 45, 50, 60 years. And everybody that I've ever talked to says that they recognize that their brains and their minds have a stimulating experience, and that's the Lincoln Memorial in Washington.
Mm.
Anybody who's ever been there cannot tell you why, and I cannot tell you why, but people do have an experience that they recognize is different than just walking into an empty building anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, Robert McGee, I know you specialize in space for scientists, and we have lots of scientists listening to this program, of course. What do they want from their workspaces?
First, they want to make sure it works. Okay. It's got you've got to solve the functional problem first, and then what? Then you, if you know how to do that, then you have the opportunity to address other issues like what kind of social environment can you create, what kind of aesthetic environment can you create. One of the things I think is important, and your other guest said it was futile to think about designing buildings 10 years from now. Well, all we do is design buildings in the future, because the last thing we ought to be doing is addressing what scientists are doing today. So that's the only thing we know they won't be doing 5 years and 10 years from today. So we have to think about these buildings in a broader sense. And what we spend a lot of time on what makes a good building, not how to solve an individual scientist's needs. Mm-hmm. And that really has helped us reshape buildings from being very idiosyncratic to being more generalized, and then we can spend more time and attention to focus on what really makes a great lab space. Was it 10-foot tall ceilings, 11-foot tall ceilings, a lot of glass, the kind of cabinetry that goes into it, and so on.
And now, but John Eberhard was telling us about the Jonas Salk experience, which is very much different than what you're talking about, a laboratory space. He was saying how he was inspired by going to that building, and you know, an epiphany happened. And that's not going to happen every day in a laboratory, is it, by designing your lab space?
Well, it might. I mean, the lab I'm working on right now with Raphael Vannoli, from every lab you see outside, you can walk outside because it's stair-stepped mm-hmm. up a hill. So you can get out of your lab immediately to the outside, and you can change, you know, your whole environment in just a few steps. And no other lab is able to do that. So we're trying to make a place that just by doing that attracts good scientists to come there. And all of our postdocs and bright people say the most important thing about a lab building is not the building, but the kind of people who are there.
Interesting.
So our first goal is to attract good scientists.
And a corollary, the opposite, I would think, that if your workers feel that the building is designed for them, you know, and they're feelings to maximize how their pleasurable experience and whatever, would they not say, hey, I think I'll work harder for my bosses because they really have me in mind here?
Well, I think they do, and I think we acknowledge that they're going to be there 14, 16 hours a day, mm-hmm. and so I want to make a place that they want to say, boy, I really like going and working there, mm-hmm. and it's the best lab I've ever been in. Because I think it helps their everyday getting up and going to work everyday experience.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Alan in North Carolina. Hi, Alan.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi.
I wanted to bring to your attention the recording studio industry, which has changed dramatically over the last 50 years. If you look back at pictures of Elvis recording in the 50s, they tended to be drab control rooms with white acoustic tiles and a clock on the wall. Now you have record companies paying to send their artists to exotic locales in the Caribbean. There's a very successful studio in Nashville built out of a giant barn. Churches are common. There's a big emphasis on natural light, on amenities. Even some of them are practically bed and breakfast. So,
and you have you have Skywalker Ranch, where a lot of recording artists.
Yes, same idea. In fact, Lucas, I think, was definitely ahead of the curve as far as the Hollywood studios go by setting that place up, and now he attracts a lot of business from Los Angeles.
So that's certainly designed with the user in mind, and to maximize their creativity or really desire to go there.
Right. You may have two studios that have identical equipment, the same mixing console, the same tape decks, but the artist chooses one over the other because they feel that they're going to get a better product. And the record company banks money that the product is actually going to sound better just because of the environment.
John Eberhard, any comments on that?
Well, I think that's true. And what we are trying to explore now is, because there is an experience that people have like this, and the recording studios is one example, we know what seems to be conducive to their increased performance, but we don't know why. And what we hope to be able to do in neuroscience studies over the next 10 years, because it's going to take a while,
is to begin to answer the questions about what's happening in the brain and the mind of people that will answer questions of why they have these positive experiences.
Well, thanks for calling. Good luck to you, Alan. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to David in Little Rock. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I've been listening to this, and you were talking about taking these people to all these places and tweaking this and tweaking that. Why don't you just use virtual reality on these people, and you'll have infinite variability of your different inputs as far as visual stimuli, oral stimuli, and olfactory for that matter, and find out what makes people tick just sitting in one spot thinking they're traveling all over the world and all kinds of different environments and spaciousness and light.
Great idea. Dr. Marcano, can you do that?
Well, I think, yes, of course. And I think a number of studies are beginning to utilize our ability to create spaces, virtual spaces that are very realistic, actually. And, of course, you know about things like flight trainers and so on that really give you a sensation of being somewhere else, you know, driving an airplane or whatever.
Yeah, but when you're talking about going through the Lincoln Tunnel, I was thinking, God, that'd be so easy to do with a flight simulator and a virtual reality helmet. There you go. You have no reason not to believe you're going through the Lincoln Tunnel. You could send thousands of people a day through the Lincoln Tunnel and they're all nice, in a chair.
Well, I'm not sure that is not just going to be a stress inducer rather than a stress.
Oh, sure, sure.
But I think that the important point to keep in mind is that by creating a virtual reality, and I like this this question, is you have a lot more control over the parameters. You can
absolutely
actually create a Lincoln Tunnel and then make it bigger, light it up, change the color, and see if, you know, what happens to people's reactions.
I've been in the Lincoln Tunnel. You don't want to be there, especially when the lights are out.
One of the problems about moving people, as in the earlier example, from one office setting to the other, is you're creating so many variables, you don't know which one is really contributing. And the issue of virtual reality would really let you tick these things off one at a time. And I think is a promising idea.
Let me ask you, take it from a different tack of going back. You know, science usually starts out on the other end. It starts out with animal studies. Is it possible to use, animal studies to find out the effects of any of these influences on the brains or the nervous systems or what the creativity of rats or monkeys or anything like that?
Well, I think we have to be very careful in projecting from other animals to human beings. Of course, primates are as close as we can get, but even there, the set of experiences may be leading in the wrong direction. On the other hand, for very simple kinds of things, like, for example, the perception of where you are with respect to a room, where you are in a room, what are the various features that you key in on. We're learning a lot actually from studying mice. That gives us an idea of what we should be looking for in humans, but I think we have to be careful in projecting. And that's, therefore, we have to use a lot of non-invasive types of analysis in order to see what the human brain is doing, since we actually do not do experiments that are invasive on human beings.
I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about neuroarchitecture this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And Dr. Macano, would there be underlying biological or evolutionary reasons why we might respond to certain shapes or colors or smells or environmental influences?
Well, I imagine that if one looks at the human brain as the result of millions of years of evolution, that it has been fine-tuned for responding to various kinds of environmental cues. And particularly if you look at some of the innate properties of the brain, like the ability to respond positively to certain, for example, intervals of sounds, or for certain types of proportions and things like that, they're probably a result of evolutionary trends. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, a hallmark of the brain is how plastic it is, how much we can modify it through training, through education, through experience, and so on.
There's such a cultural content here also that, for instance, when we sit down with the scientists, their world of labs is generally their last lab, and our job is to show them the whole other world. So I think people bring a lot that they've learned from their environment in assessing a new environment.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way to study or measure how much the healing effect might be from an environment, from the architecture on some of our brains, maybe, you know, some sort of dementia or Alzheimer's or something like that?
Well, there was one study that was done a few years ago now on patients who were in hospital rooms recovering from operations. And half of these patients were in rooms in which they had a window that looked out on a natural view, and half of the patients were in rooms where the windows looked out on a blank wall. And the patients who were in the rooms with the good view were in the hospital for 1.5 days less in terms of their recovery time. They needed less medicine, and the nurses said they were easier to care for. So at least there was some empirical evidence that these windows did change the rate of recovery of patients in those hospital rooms.
Does that mean... I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
A similar experiment was done in Rhode Island about changing the width and the character of the hospital corridor and making visitors dress up in bathrobes when they came to visit the patient, so that it became a patient's world instead of the patient invading the public world. And the people in general healed or were discharged almost 50% earlier than people in traditional settings.
That's an amazing statistic. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more, take more of your questions on neuroarchitecture, this new field of designing buildings to make you feel better, maybe actually make you get well and help solve some of your problems with Robert McGee, John Eberhard, and Eduardo Macano. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and a brief program note. Join Neil Conan on Monday for a look at public school through the eyes of a former New York City Teacher of the Year. Does schooling get in the way of education? That's on Monday's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking this hour about the influence of architecture and design on the mind. My guests are Robert McGee, Institute Architect for the Howard Hughes Medical Institution. John Eberhard is the Latrobe Fellow on the Board of Fellows at the American Institute of Architects and Advisory Board Member at the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture. Eduardo Macano is the Dean of the School of Biological Sciences at the University of California, San Diego. Our number, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can take a phone call or two. Let's go to John in Westminster, Colorado. Hi, John.
Hi, Ira. This is John.
Go ahead.
I worked in a beautiful building down in the Denver Tech Center. Had lots of glass, nice atmosphere, except for one thing. It had white noise coming from the ceiling, and it was very irritating day or night. And finally, we peeked above the white ceiling tiles and saw canisters distributed every so often with little speakers that were putting out the white noise. And after turning those off, when people came in the next morning, it was much more pleasant, and most folks just didn't know why until I told them.
That's interesting. Gentlemen, any comment? Did they think they were doing you a favor, John, with the white noise? They did.
Well, part of the problem there is, and one of the reasons that we are now exploring more research on the mind and the brain, is that the people who put in those canisters were going by intuitive information. That is, intuitively they understood, they thought, that white noise in the background would help mask the other noise that was occurring in those offices. But since they didn't know why, and they didn't know why in terms of the brain, and they didn't know what this would mean to people in fact, turns out they were wrong. Their intuitions were wrong, and sounds like the other John solved the problem all by himself.
That sounds like what you're saying is there's too much guesswork going on here in
That's
design.
Right.
designing these. Thanks, John in Westminster, for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Since you're all talking about studies that show if you look out a window, you feel better, open windows, would it be better if we were all outside? Is that the ultimate architecture, to be out in nature? Or can there, you know, can somebody say, hey, you know, I love the inside of the building and rather be inside if it were designed correctly?
Well, there are many things that we cannot do outside, of course. For a variety of reasons. It rains, for example. There's wind. You know, we don't control the elements so well, so I think we are kind of limited to having portholes or windows so that we can think of the outside. The interesting thing, though, might be to look at why the mind interprets that image of the outside as comforting. And it may be that all you need to have is you know, a false picture of the outside, and that might be sufficiently good. You know, have a couple of Magrites on the wall, and that might be sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be something we would want to study a bit.
Mm-hmm. They do that in hospitals sometimes to put. Yeah, I'm sorry. Who was trying to jump in there?
I was going to say it's the same man that did the study of the hospital windows, who's a professor at Texas A&M University, Roger Ulrich, also has been studying the use of paintings and the painting of natural scenes introduced into waiting rooms in the hospitals where mm-hmm. patients are waiting to be admitted. And he claims, at least, that these paintings of natural scenes were also calming for the people who were waiting there.
Bob McGee, were you trying to jump in there?
Yeah, I think there's the other dimension, and one is the color of the light and the source of the light, and then just the ability to focus distant versus close. I think those things are immensely relaxing to people, and it's very hard to duplicate those artificially.
How about the idea that you can actually have the freedom to get up out of your desk and take a walk someplace, or from your assembly line and get off the line and, you know, take a walk to free your mind up or get away from the tedium? Is that the kind of thing you could study also? Or is that just...
Well, I think Kevin in the Campshire indicated earlier that one of the factors that appears to be the case with people who work in offices is whether or not they can control their own destiny. Can they control the amount of light that they have? Can they mm-hmm. control the temperature? Can they control, in this case, getting up and walking around? And if you feel that you have that kind of control of your environment and your social life, then I presume that that contributes to making one more productive.
Mm-hmm. We actually want people to get up and walk around. In our labs, you can't have coffee or food, so we make the places convenient to the lab, but in places that are close, and almost force them to run into other people. So we use that as sort of a community building or mm-hmm. increasing the social content of the building, which we also think increases the intellectual content.
Yeah, there are stories about placing the coffee pot strategically interdepartmentally in a spot where everybody from different departments, having nothing to do with each other, have to, you know, exchange information. Hey, what are you working on today? Oh, I got an answer for that, you know, or a suggestion. The communal well, so to speak. 1-800-989... Go ahead.
And it works.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255. Robin in Virginia Beach. Hi, Robin.
Yes, how do you do? I'm glad to have this opportunity to say the word good vibes or bad vibes and still maintain a little bit of respect among my design colleagues. There was a study a good while ago by structural engineers, I think it was by B&K in Northern Europe, and the structural engineers quite frequently design for the natural resonance of structures, oftentimes without the architects or the owner even knowing about it. There are certain frequencies that were found to be conducive, and certain others that caused a malaise, that sort of thing. And these were due to frequencies, infrasound, you would call it, below 20 cycles per second. And that paper was written, it was back quite a ways back, I think in the 70s. And it can be dug up, but B&K set up a complete isolation chamber to study the reactions of people at certain frequencies.
Hmm.
And I can give you a very easy example of how it makes you feel. Drive your car down the highway with your window rolled down.
Uh-huh.
A larger car will give you a higher frequency that's unpleasant. A smaller car can be quite fun with the windows down. So structural engineers now are doing this. Eigenvalue method of analysis allows us to do this, especially with the finite element method by computer. You'll see this also in automobiles. They call it noise, vibration, and harshness. Different kinds of cars pitched to different kinds of people are designed to have these fun frequencies in them.
Interesting, because you know, some of that low rumble that you really are not aware of.
And this is also applicable to HVAC systems as well.
All right, Robin, thanks for calling. Very interesting.
Yeah, like I say, it's good for an engineer to actually be able to say good vibes and bad vibes and still have a little respect.
I mean, it's not 40 years ago, is what...
Okay, now you're dating me.
Dating me, or all of us. Thanks for calling. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Do engineers pay enough attention to the sound? That's an interesting aspect. To architects about rumblings and, you know, what footsteps will do and reverberations and the elevator working and stuff like that?
Well, once again,
they do
it depends.
In science?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
They do in science buildings. I mean, we have to control vibration to have a certain instrumentation that works. We also are real sensitive to mechanical noise, because the kinds of buildings we're building now are going to be much more flexible than the ones we built in the past. It might not be a lab 10 years from now. It might be a computational space. It can't be noisy. We really have to pay attention to the light, the noise, the finishes. Everything.
Interesting. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about neuroacoustics, the idea of building buildings and how they affect our minds, this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We only have a few minutes left, gentlemen. Let me put your thinking caps on. I'll start with you. I know, John Eberhard, you talked about Jonas Salk and going out there to California. Can you name a building that you think is just a terrific example so we can visit it? A terrific example of something that is awe-inspiring and mind-boggling and gets you to think and stuff like that. Is there any that you can think of that was open to the public or we can weasel our way into?
Well, I already mentioned one, and I think one of your callers misunderstood the name I said. It's the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., not the Lincoln Tunnel in New York City. There's quite a difference.
It's quite a difference what's on either end of them.
Right.
Let me ask Madigan, Bob McGee, any suggestions or anything on your campus that Howard Hughes that inspires you?
I take a lot of people through the Salk Institute and got a chance years ago to sort of duplicate a building like it over on the UCSD campus. But right now I think the building we're trying to do now is far-reaching as any that I know of, and that's with Vinoli at our Janelia Farm campus that's under construction now.
Dr. McCunyo?
Well, I must say that I think that we're so culturally bound to some extent that looking for great buildings may be a matter of our own experiences. I was going to say my favorite place, I was at Columbia University for many years. One of my favorite places to just walk from my lab to and reflect was St. John the Divine. It's a fantastic cathedral and a fantastic space with lots of resonances and enormous natural beauty. It's unfinished, as you know, but whatever is finished is certainly, to me, conducive to thinking deeply and kind of making different connections.
Would you gentlemen think that a garden is important, place to get out?
I thought that perhaps Eduardo was going to be talking about walking through Central Park. Because the designs by Olmsted of Central Park are attributed by many people to be very conducive.
Yes. I agree with that, John, but it was easier to get to St. John the Divine than to Central Park.
Okay.
Well, because, you know, you read about all these famous people from Einstein to Salk to say that I need to take a little walk to think about this thing,
right.
You know, and having one that place to walk.
One of the great places to walk in New York City is the Rockefeller University campus.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's true.
It's just a great a change from the street. You're in a different world.
It's true. You have to be able to get on the campus now, and New York is a secure place.
And we should give Mr. Salk the lasting credit here at the end, perhaps, that walking down the middle of his Salk Institute, which he was instrumental with Lou Kahn, the architect, in having designed, is an inspiration in itself.
All right, that's the last word, and it's a nice note to end on. I'd like to thank my guests. Jen Eberhardt is a Latrobe Fellow on the Board of Fellows at the American Institute of Architects and Advisory Board Member, the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture. Robert McGee is the Institute Architect for the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and Eduardo Macaño is the Dean of the School of Biological Sciences at the University of California, San Diego, an Advisory Board Member of the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture. Gentlemen, thanks for taking time from your vacations to talk with us today.
All right.
I appreciate
it.
Thank you. Have a good
weekend.
Thank
you, Irene. Thank you.
Earlier, we spoke with Kevin Campshire, Director of Research for the GSA's Public Building Service. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York, Paul Franklin in Houston. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. Serve over to our website at sciencefriday.com for any comments, questions, or other links to the topics. Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. Also, you can get back editions of Science Friday on Real Audio or take them with you on your Audible player. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.